There's a culture war going on in this country. We can no longer remain silent on the issues that affect us all. Decisions we make now will determine our future. But how do we engage with the culture in a way that honors Jesus? How do we rise above the noise to know what is right and what is true? It's time to bring God back into the conversation. It's time to reconnect. Here's Carmen.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LaBurge. This is The Reconnect. We're here to speak the truth on the real issues of the day in real time. So how do we do that? How do we get God back into the conversation? How do we enter into the conversations of the day as the ambassadors of Jesus Christ? And how do we speak the mind of Christ and not our own mind or our own opinion on the matters of the day? Let's face it. People don't need just another piece of my mind or a piece of your mind or an opinion piece. But they very much need the peace of the mind of Christ. So how do we give that to them? How do we speak the truth in love in the midst of a culture that is frankly upside down and confused about so many, many things? Well, in order to equip you to do that, I invite you to meet me at reconnectwithcarmen.com. I got all kinds of resources posted for you there. And just go grab some stuff that'll help you. Hey, one of the things that's posted today is an equipping resource, particularly surrounding this weekend. So this Sunday is the International Day of Prayer for persecuted Christians, and we have a resource, an ebook posted for you there on sort of getting your mind around the whole concept of persecution and what's going on around the world today, and specifically how to be praying for our persecuted brothers and sisters around the world. We also talked yesterday with a representative from Open Doors USA. We have talked with representatives from Voice of the Martyrs and others who interact with, represent, and advocate for persecuted Christians around the world. So there's a series of podcasts, former shows from The Reconnect, and you can get all of those at reconnectwithcarmen.com. Okay, let me lead off with taxes. Taxes. Taxes is kind of a terrible subject, but we have to talk about it because it is literally the news of the day. So tax cuts, it's called the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which you can't say very quickly because it's a lot of S sounds. So the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which is, I'm just going to call it tax reform. So Speaker of the House Paul Ryan hosted a press conference on Thursday introducing the Tax Cuts Jobs Act. It reduces the number of tax brackets from 7 to 4, nearly doubles the standard deduction, raising the standard deduction for singles to $12,000. It's currently like $6,350, and it raises the standard deduction for married couples who are filing jointly to $24,000, which is currently $12,700. So that's really significant. That one part is very significant. I think that you are going to hear churches and other nonprofit organizations probably bend into the conversation at this particular point. If folks are going to get a standard deduction of those levels, how is that going to affect? Not is it going to affect, but how is that going to affect charitable giving? Because there are certainly some people who are motivated to make charitable contributions in order that they can then deduct them from their taxes. So that's going to be part of the conversation, just sort of giving you a heads up about that. Plan calls for leaving the top individual tax rate at 39.6%. If you are in the 39.6% tax bracket, you need to be donating to this ministry. So you need to go to reconnectwithcarmen.com and hit the Donate Now button. If you're listening to this program and you didn't even know there was a 39.6% tax bracket, hey, I'm with you. Okay, so it's going to push the income threshold for the 39.6% tax bracket to $1 million for married couples. It is currently $480,050. So just to let you know, those of you who are earning more than $1 million in terms of your household, your tax rate is very close to 40%, but that's not news for you. And there you go. Okay. The bill is heavily weighted toward business. I'm now reading from a little roundup in the New York Times. The bill is heavily weighted toward business, which would receive about a $1 trillion net cut in taxes, or two-thirds of the total that we're looking for in terms of the tax savings that would actually happen because of this bill. So at the center of all of this is a proposal to permanently cut the corporate tax rate to 20%. Currently, the corporate tax rate in America is 35%, which is what which drives lots of U.S. companies to move abroad and then keep their money overseas. And so what we're looking for is a way to get all that offshore money back here, moving around in the United States, which gets the economy going. And so you can think of this tax plan as also a stimulus. Okay, so from a Christian worldview, you know, what do we have to say about all these things? Well, let's start with this. When asked, should we pay taxes? And how should we pay taxes? You know, just remember, Jesus was pretty clear. We are to render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and unto God what is God's. Now, a lot of people will say, hey, God says mine over everything. And so because it's God's, it's his, and I don't have to pay the government anything in terms of taxes. That's actually a total perversion of the teaching. So, you know, Jesus says, look at the coin. Whose face is on it? Well, it's Caesar's. Well, then who does it belong to? Well, it belongs to Caesar. Okay, well, render under Caesar what is Caesar's. Render under God what is God's. You're the image bearer of God. Your life is to be rendered unto him. Are you living as a living sacrifice? Are you offering your life as a living sacrifice that you might be found holy and acceptable in his sight? Is that your true spiritual worship? I mean, if not, who are you rending your life unto? So you and I are image bearers of the living God, and we render our lives to him. Our coinage, our paper money, all the currency with which we go about doing the business of this world, it bears the image of some nation state or some, I say that, and then of course we get into the whole cryptocurrency conversation, and I have to remind myself it's actually a global currency that is based in the internet, so I don't really know how that's going to work in terms of interpretive keys, so I should leave that laying right there since I shouldn't have even picked it up on that subject. But there you go. If we're talking about American dollars and you're going to be taxed on them, there's a picture on those bills, and that is sort of the modern Caesar of the day. Okay, what are some of the other things in here that you and I need to know about? The Tax Cuts Jobs Act would repeal the existing deduction for state and local income and sales taxes and would cap the deduction for state and local property taxes at $10,000. So if you are annually paying more than $10,000 in property taxes, both state and local combined, you are going to see this as problematic. If you live in a state that allows for, or you in a state that has state income tax, we all have state sales tax, I think, but some states don't have state income tax. Many of us, even in those states, have local income tax. So this is a complicated formula, but my guess is that the fact that none of these things are now going to be deductible is going to affect blue states more than is going to affect red states. Why is that? Well, because for whatever reason, the tax base seems to be a whole lot higher in blue states than red states. So you're going to hear a lot of carping and barking from California and New Jersey in particular. They don't like this. And so just be ready to hear your friends from those communities speaking very loudly about how unjust this tax reform bill is. Regarding mortgage interest deduction, which is of interest to a lot of people, the bill would allow existing mortgages to keep the current rules, which means that you and I get to deduct the interest that we pay on our mortgages. There is going to be a cap on that going forward in terms of the first $500,000 worth of loans, but for those who have existing mortgages or would not be looking at buying property where they would be mortgaging more than $500,000, I think that this is good news that the mortgage interest will continue to be deductible. All right, and then there is this related to the child tax credit. The bill seeks to raise the child tax credit to $1,600 from its current maximum of $1,000. That leads us into the conversation that I really want to have for a couple of minutes, because the big issue for Christians in the bill, the big issue for Christians is that the current, in its current form, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act eliminates the tax credit for adoption. Yes, you heard me right. The current bill eliminates the tax credit for adoption. This is National Adoption Month, so let's settle in right here for just a moment on this particular issue, because for Christians, this should be the sticking point. This should be the point of advocacy and concern and what gets us on the phones to our congressmen and congresswomen on this subject. So what is the adoption tax credit, you might be wondering? Well, it was initially passed in 1997. It was a broad bipartisan piece of legislation The adoption tax credit eases the financial burden that families face when they're going through an adoption. So since 1997, hundreds of thousands of families across the U.S. have used the adoption tax credit to make adoption financially feasible. We want people to be adopting kids who need a family. Like, there's a social motivation, in addition to there just being a pure Christian motivation, there's a social motivation to have kids in families and not as wards of the state. And so we want to see kids adopted. If you are pro-life, this is your issue. Right? We are not just about being sure that babies that are conceived are born. We are also about those babies who are born growing up in the context of families who are willing and able to love them and raise them and nurture them. And in order to do that, some families need some financial support, and that's where the adoption tax credit came in. So the adoption tax credit is available for families who adopt through foster care, private domestic adoption, and international adoption. The credit is currently $13,570. Now, there's a limit in terms of how much you can make in order to claim that, but this is a really important component part of this conversation, because adoptions can easily cost more than $60,000 or $70,000 for just one adoption. And so for a lot of Americans, the adoption tax credit actually makes a huge difference in determining whether or not they'll be able to afford to adopt. Over 60% of adopted children are adopted by middle and lower income taxpayers, which means they need this kind of support in order to adopt children. So I think this is a really important provision in our current tax code, and I very much want to see it preserved going forward. And so you say, well, what's the Christian motivation in all of this? Well, first of all, adoption is central to the gospel. It's central to the gospel. Not only does the Bible provide lots of instances of God protecting orphans and urging his followers to do the same, but the gospel also tells us that every Christian is adopted. You and I are adopted into the kingdom of God through Jesus Christ. Adoption is certainly one way in which God chooses to provide for children. And we're all better off if children grow up in loving families to be healthier and more successful people compared with those who grow up in the foster care system. Now, foster care is really important. If you're a foster care family, I am praising God for you today. But I also want to encourage, in this National Adoption Month, I want to encourage people to really be considering opening their homes and their hearts to kids who are currently in the foster care system who need homes. We are constantly reminded on this program by people like Kelly Rosati of Focus on the Family that if one family in every three churches in America were to adopt a child currently available for adoption in America through the foster care system, there'd literally be no more orphans in America. We should consider that for just a moment. Well, right now, there is a tax, I don't even want to call it an incentive, but there's some help in the form of the adoption tax credit in order to help people do that. We don't want to see that go away. So we want to see the preservation of the adoption tax credit in tax reform going forward. And so if you're concerned about this issue, I'm going to just go ahead and encourage you to call your U.S. representative and share your concerns. Lots of conversations are going to be had about this in the days going forward. You're going to hear lots of people say, hey, every special interest group out there is going to be, you know, knocking on the door of their representatives and, you know, pleading their case for whatever their special interest is in relationship to taxes. This is not a special interest. This is a national concern. Adoption is not a special interest group. And certainly kids who need to be adopted are not in a position to call their members of Congress. So you and I need to be speaking on behalf of those who are very, very vulnerable in our culture, kids who need to be adopted into families. And I believe it's a positive thing for the U.S. tax code to support that. All right, let me move from the U.S. tax code to those meddling Russians. All right, if you're not up to speed on the meddling Russians, which I think we should just start referring to them as the meddling Russians. If you're not up to speed on this, look, there are these things in Russia called troll farms. I know, and you're saying to yourself, really? Like the trolls under the bridge in Billy Goat's Gruff? No, unfortunately, they're not those kinds of trolls. These are internet trolls, and they actually have these internet troll farms, which I can't even believe that that's not, I can't even believe that's a sensical statement. That should be a nonsensical statement. But in this current context, we actually can have a conversation about Russian troll farms and the way that Russian operatives bought ads on Facebook to divide Americans over some of our most sensitive social issues. So here's basically what senators, lawmakers across the board, but senators in particular, have been learning in their hearings about Russian influence in the 2016 campaign. I'm going to read one paragraph from a Washington Post technology article entitled "Russian Ads, Now Publicly Released, Show Sophistication of Influence Campaign." So here's the paragraph. The ads that emerged, a sampling of the 3,000 that Russians bought during the 2016 presidential campaign and its aftermath, demonstrated in words and images a striking ability to mimic American political discourse at its most fractious. The targeted information also showed a shrewd understanding of how best to use Facebook to find and influence voters most likely to respond to the pitches. Now, let me just warn you in advance that you were probably targeted. At one level or another, you were probably targeted to influence your vote or influence your advocacy leading up to the vote in terms of the 2016 election. Why do I suggest that? Well, because if you were a person who Facebook, now keep in mind, Facebook knows more about us than we know about ourselves. That, I mean, they have algorithms that are constantly fishing around in the things that we're typing and the things that we're liking and the things that we're reading. They're keeping track of stuff that we are not keeping track of. Our eyes scan over something and they're like, you know, they're like marking that down. You and I aren't necessarily marking it down, but they are. And they know that you got to see something a certain number of times before you actually click on it and a certain number of more times before you actually buy it. And so they keep putting it in front of you. Well, the Russians were banking on the algorithms of Facebook to get their messaging in front of the people most likely to click on it, most likely to like it, most likely then to pass it on to others, in order that we would use our influence with one another to sow discontent, to foment all kinds of aggressive behavior amongst Americans in the lead up to the 2016 presidential campaign. So they were seeking to have this online influence that would have real world consequences. And that's actually what senators are seeking to investigate. So I particularly like this quote by Dianne Feinstein. She's not somebody that I often quote nor positively comment on. So let me give her cred where cred is due. Senator Feinstein said to these representatives of these technology companies in the Senate hearing, "I don't think you get it." Now, you have to remember, she comes from the state where Facebook, Google, and Twitter are all headquartered. And she said, "I don't think you get it. What we're talking about is a major foreign power with sophistication and ability to involve themselves in a presidential election and sow conflict and discontent all over this country." She promised, "Hey, we're not going to go away, gentlemen. This is a very big deal." So how did they do it? Well, they did it, again, from a Russian troll farm in St. Petersburg, Russia. 470 accounts and pages that they were running from that one location and through which they bought 3,000 ads. But mostly what they did was post what we would consider ordinary free posts, like you and I post stuff on Facebook. We do it for free. It's a free platform where we seek to influence one another in one way or another. And 126 million Americans, Facebook now says, were directly reached by these Russian-backed Facebook groups who were targeting their messaging. Facebook said that it has 10,000 employees and contractors working on safety and security issues, and that they're going to look at doubling that number by the end of 2018. Now, I'm pretty sure it was on a prior show when it's been a while back now, where we actually talked about the fact that Facebook has not only more people than any country in the world, any nation on earth, but it actually has more money and more financial influence and more global reach than any nation state. And so if the United States wants to somehow convict, you know, bring some sort of social pressure to bear on a company that's actually now bigger than a country and has more global influence than America herself even has, I just think we have sort of reached that inflection point in terms of influence and who is going to listen to who. So, as Christians, what does all of this mean and what should we be doing? Well, first of all, we need to recognize the power of media, particularly social media, to influence us and to co-opt us as we influence others. So I want you to really think about the things that you click on and like and retweet and pass along to others. So the Apostle Paul reminds us that I pass along to you what I in turn also received. And he's talking there about the gospel. And you and I need to be those kinds of ambassadors. We need to be passing on to others that which we received in terms of gospel, but not passing along to others that which we receive from sources we do not know that are seeking to sow discord and foment disunity in our country. You and I actually know that the seeds of division among us are the work not only of maybe a national enemy like Russia, but they're actually the work of the enemy. That's what the enemy is trying to do. The enemy is trying to sow seeds of division among us. Jesus wants unity. Jesus wants unity among his people, and Jesus wants to bring down every dividing wall of hostility between us in our culture. All right, so we got to be not just a Jesus first people, but we got to be a Jesus only people. Hey, we're in the midst of the 500th anniversary celebration of the Reformation. We got to get back to that Christ alone business. We got to be people who, in everything that we think, say, and do, we are Christ alone people, not Christ plus some other identity characteristic. Just Christ, just Jesus. We got to be just Jesus people. Christ alone is a just Jesus motto. And so if you and I on social media are constantly seeking to be distinctively Christian, just Jesus, just Jesus. And you say, well, I'm going to become, you know, tiresome if on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, I'm just the Jesus person. Like, aren't people going to grow tired of that? Well, you know what? They hated him. And they crucified him. And you say to yourself, well, that doesn't sound like a whole lot of fun. I'm not really interested in that. Okay, you are in the world as a representative of Jesus Christ, literally to represent him to others. You're not here for yourself and for your own good and for your own glory and for the, you know, for the elevation of your own name. It's actually not about you. It's all about Jesus. And so how can I give this one life that God has given to me, how can I give it back to him to use in this generation to advance his kingdom purposes and for his glory, to elevate the name of Jesus in the culture in which I live, for the day in which I live? That's the question I want to be pounding in our hearts. Not what nasty thing can I pass along on Facebook or Twitter to further inflame the racial division conversation in the culture, or to further inflame the division between Democrats and Republicans, or to further inflame hatred toward people who come from another land or who don't know Jesus because they think God is Allah. This is what I want us to be thinking about. What provokes you on Facebook or Twitter to click? And then how can you use your social media influence to get people clicking on Jesus? Clicking with Jesus, maybe. All right, we actually have a resource on our website at reconnectwithcarmen.com that we developed with Jeremy, his last name escaped me there for a second, Jeremy Burton, on social media influence and how Christians need to be paying attention to what we're doing on social media. And we need to be committed to being people who only tell the truthful things that are upbuilding to others, glorifying to God and edifying to other people. So if you need a little social media checkup because you think, you know what, I was probably one of those people duped by those Russian trolls, then I want you to go to reconnectwithcarmen.com and find the social media resource. And I want you to consider taking the social media pledge that, you know, Christians are taking in order to ensure that we are people who pass along to others gospel truth and not just the lies of the enemy seeking to sow division and discord among people. All right, friends, we're about out of time for this half. I wanted to visit this subject matter. If you don't ever go to the College Fix, you got to go to the College Fix website. It's thecollegefix.com, and you can read there about a college professor who thinks white people need to stop having babies because after all, it's just racist. It's just racist for us to be having babies. That's a conversation we ought to engage in, because there is real racism, but that's not it. All right, this is The Reconnect. I'm Carmen LaBurge. We'll be right back. Visit me online at reconnectwithcarmen.com.
And I don't want to spend my life stuck in a pattern. And I don't want to gain this world, but lose what matters. So I'm giving up everything because I want to be different. I want to be changed till all of me is gone. And all that remains is a fire so
friends, I'm Carmen LaBurge. This is The Reconnect. We're trying to put God in his place. That makes us different. We're trying to put God back where he belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. We're talking about what people are talking about. We're seeking to equip you to be an ambassador of the kingdom of God in the midst of the kingdoms of this world. We're seeking you to be a blessing, seeking to help you be a blessing to others. Hey, I invite you to connect with us online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can like us on Facebook. You can always let me know what you're thinking about. I'm on Twitter at Carmen LaBurge. All right, I just connected on Twitter with our next guest. So let me just tell you in advance, you can connect with him on Twitter at Jewish_voice. That's Jewish_voice. His name is Jonathan Burness. He's been with us here on The Reconnect before. We are thrilled to have him back today. He's a leader in the Messianic Jewish ministry, and he's been engaged in this for more than 30 years. He's probably one of, if not the most well-respected Messianic Jewish voice in the country. And so I'm privileged to have him here again today. He currently serves as the president and CEO of Jewish Voice Ministries International. That's JVMI. He hosts their syndicated television program, which is Jewish Voice with Jonathan Burness. And you can check all of that out at jewishvoice.org. We're going to talk about a lot of things today, one of which is his latest book, Unlocking the Prophetic Mysteries of Israel, Seven Keys to Understanding Israel's Role in the End Times. So again, it's Jonathan Burness. Welcome back to The Reconnect.
Really good to be back with you, Carmen.
All right, so let's sort of put a pin at this point in history, because I think that for a lot of people, when we just think about Israel and we think about something like Israel's role in the end times, we need a little bit of we need a history lesson in terms of where Israel is right now and who it is that we're talking about. So just yesterday, we recognized or acknowledged the 100th anniversary of the issuance of the Balfour Declaration. So using that as a, you know, as a good pivot point, give us sort of Israel at this point in human history.
Okay, so, and that's what I do in the book. I go back really far. I go back all the way to the Garden of Eden in the book, because I think that lays the foundation for understanding the role of Israel. And when we go back to the beginning, we see a world that's created to perfection. It's a paradise. According to the rabbis, the Garden of Eden, which they call Gan Eden, is paradise. It's the Hebrew word for paradise. Gan Eden is paradise. And in the midst of this paradise, God places man and has a perfect relationship with him. It's the same kind of relationship that's described in the Godhead, Echad in Hebrew, which is one. They're one. In fact, I found an interesting verse in Genesis chapter 3, verse 8, that talks about the voice of the Lord walking in the garden. Do you recall that
statement? Yes, absolutely.
The voice of the Lord walking in the garden. It never made
any
sense.
Well, I've never thought about it that way. I've never thought about that. I have thought of it as the Lord is walking in the garden, but I've never thought of it as the voice of the Lord walking in the garden.
Well, it actually, the voice of, or the sound, and it was the rabbis that translated the Hebrew Bible into Aramaic that really came to understand this when they chose the Aramaic word memra, which is word. It was the word of the Lord walking in the garden. And I believe this is the pre-incarnate Christ that's part of this perfect harmony and relationship with man in the garden. And then this paradise is then violently shifted when Adam and Eve sin against God and eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, beguiled by the serpent. And everything changes, completely changes. The earth is transformed, mankind is transformed, man who was created to live eternally in this human form now dies. Three deaths: spiritual death, which is separation from God; physical death, the aging process begins, and man then drops in lifespan to 1,000 years, 120 years, makes its way down to 70 to 80 years. And then an animal dies because God has to cover the nakedness of man with the animal sacrifice, because the life of the blood is in the flesh. The life of the flesh is in the blood, rather. So you have blood sacrifice going all the way back to the Adamic covenant, the shedding of blood, three deaths. And in the midst of this terrible change, where death comes into the world and evil comes into the world through sin, you have a promise in Genesis 3:15. And by the way, the state of Israel, and we just celebrated, as you said, the 100th year of the Balfour Declaration, the return of the Jewish people back to their land, is all tied into this thing in Genesis, believe it or not. Genesis 3:15, the Lord decrees a sentence, a death sentence over Satan. And we have what scholars call the proto-evangelion, the first promise of redemption, of the gospel, when he says, "I'll put a division, enmity, between you and the woman, and between his seed and your seed. Your seed will bruise his heel," cause affliction, in other words, but minorly, "but his seed," or her seed, will crush your head." That's the gospel, the crushing of the head of Satan, of the serpent, through the seed of the woman. That's the basis for understanding everything that follows. You have what follows in history, an unfolding of this redemptive plan of God to bring the world back to the state it was before the fall of man, and Israel is deeply connected to this. Israel's at the foundation of this, because the seed promise, first of all, is through the woman. It's the seed of the woman, which is really weird, Carmen, because the seed comes through the man in a union. It's the seed of the man. Mm. And in fact, the Septuagint says the sperma of the woman. What is it talking about? It's talking about the virgin birth, that there will be a seed that will be implanted through a woman, will be connected to Eve, but a virgin birth that will bring forth a seed promise that will ultimately destroy the head of the serpent. That means that Satan has been under a death sentence decreed by the creator of the universe since the Garden of Eden. And you don't hear anything about the seed promise. We pass through the scriptures, we read about man becoming more and more evil and rebellious, and so wicked that God has to destroy the earth with a flood, save Noah and his family, and the seed promise is preserved. And then you come upon Genesis 12, and we're introduced to a man named Abram. And Abram, whose name is then changed to Abraham later on in the story, is called by God to leave his home, leave everything behind, and go to a land that God would show him. And if he did that, God would multiply him and bless him and bless those who blessed him and curse the one who curses him. But here's the big promise, Genesis 12:3, through your seed, through your offspring, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. Carmen, that's the promise of the land that God gives to Abraham and his offspring. But that's the land grant right there. And Lord Balfour, mm-hmm. who was a devout Christian, was only recognizing that this land grant was in the Bible, and so this land, which was actually a much bigger piece of property than Israel possesses today, was divinely decreed by God himself. So he was acknowledging that in this declaration in 1917, and sadly it came to naught, but we still have this historical document of a man of God recognizing that this land belongs to a special people as an eternal possession.
Okay, let's pause there for a second. Friends, you're listening to the voice of Jonathan Burness. In addition to lots of other things, Jonathan is the voice of Jewish Voice with Jonathan Burness. It's broadcast to 717 million homes worldwide, but you can check it all out at jewishvoice.org. The book we're talking about is his latest, Unlocking the Prophetic Mysteries of Israel, Seven Keys to Understanding Israel's Role in the End Times. And Jonathan, in order to understand Israel's role in the end times, what you are setting up for us is the understanding of who Israel is as a people, the promises that God has made to Israel over the course of history. And I think that you illuminate for us already why it is that other people respond the way they do to Israel, the nation, and Israel, the people, because you've already described them as special and chosen, and other people don't like that. So let's
Absolutely
talk about
not.
That for a minute. Let's
Absolutely
talk about,
not.
Yeah, let's talk. All right, so let's just talk about that. Let's talk about
well,
that
you're
reality.
Setting up the, you're setting up the questions perfectly, the issues just perfectly clear the way that you're pointing them out, because everything goes back, in my understanding, to Genesis 3, the seed promise of the woman, which really is a key that unlocks the mystery of why Israel, because the seed promise it then becomes Abraham's offspring. Abraham becomes the carrier of the seed promise in his loins with a specific land, and this becomes God's plan of redemption for mankind. So it explains anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism mm-hmm. is understood by most scholars to be an irrational, illogical hatred of Jewish people. But in fact, it's very logical, it's very rational when you understand there is a literal Satan, a devil that seeks to thwart the plan of God, to destroy the plan and people of God, and he targets what he understands to be the carriers of this death sentence, which is the Jewish people, the seed of the woman, and he believes that he can keep his head from being crushed. The anti-Semitism, in its simplest form, is an effort to keep this death sentence that's decreed by God from coming to pass. It's really that simple. So it's very logical, it's very systematic, it's very calculated, and the Jew becomes the Jewish people. So when we talk about Israel, the wider definition is the children of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, whose name is changed to Israel, and then his children, the 12 sons, become the 12 tribes of Israel. These are the Jewish people that have been preserved to this day because God said, as long as the sun shines by day and the moon and stars by night, I'll preserve these as this nation as a people before me. So the people of Israel, which are scattered to the corners of the earth, to the nations of the earth, are the people of Israel that God has promised to preserve. He also said that he would scatter them if they disobeyed him, but there would be a time in history when he would gather them back to their land. That began in the 19th century. The modern restoration of Israel was affirmed by Lord Balfour, and then by the UN in 1947, and in 1948, the state of Israel, the land of Israel, was restored to the people of Israel, and then in 1967, the capital of Jerusalem. These are all very significant events that should be of interest to every Christian because they're part of a redemptive plan of God for the world. That's what I focus on in the book, God's redemption for the world, because God so loved the whole world that he gave his son. But the Jewish people are absolutely foundational to understanding how this all works.
Which, you know, there are even Christians who don't like that about God's redemptive plan. So let's talk for a minute about replacement theology and what's wrong with it in terms of the conversation about the return of the Messiah.
Well, great. I talk a lot about replacement theology in the book. And what I found, Carmen, is that most Christians don't even know what replacement theology is, let alone the theological term supersessionism. They just don't know. But in fact, replacement theology infiltrates most of Christian theology. It permeates Christian theology. The residue of replacement theology is everywhere. And in its simplest form, it blames the Jewish people for killing Jesus, for committing deicide, killing the Son of God, and puts the blame on them. And as a result, God is finished with the Jewish people. He's now chosen another people to replace them, thus replacement theology, called the church, and God is finished with Israel, although they're still eligible for individual salvation along with everyone else. There's no more covenantal relationship with the people of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob because of the final straw that broke the camel's back. They rejected Jesus. Now, the problem with this, Carmen, is severalfold. First of all, if God has a point at which you cross a line and he says, no more, I'm done with you as a people, then at what point did he say to the church, you know what, I've given you a mandate, you've blown it, I'm done with you too? Or the individual Christian, at what point does God wash his hands of the individual and say, that's one sin too many? Well, that would be horrible. No, we believe in a God who continues to forgive, to cleanse us from all unrighteousness, a God who's faithful, and the root of that faithfulness is a God who's been faithful to Israel. Gosh, that falls apart without seeing a God faithful to Israel.
Yeah, absolutely. And the whole concept of an everlasting covenant, I don't know what replacement theology people do with what God very clearly says in terms of the making of an everlasting covenant. So I'm with you. I think that the challenges related to replacing Israel with the church and replacing the new covenant as an entire replacement with the old, I think it ignores what Revelation says about the place of Israel. So let's move forward.
Well,
into
sure.
That.
Just
let's,
one more point, real
yeah.
quick.
Sure.
The other point is that you run. I don't think people have thought about this enough. Actually, one, that it negates a faithful God, the idea of a faithful God that we can trust. But the other thing is, you have to randomly spiritualize Scripture to come away with seeing anything other than an irrevocable covenant. You can spiritualize mm-hmm. Israel, call it the church, in the Old Testament. But if you spiritualize Israel randomly, then what's to stop you from spiritualizing the crucifixion? What's to stop you from spiritualizing the resurrection or the bodily return of Christ to this earth? That's the danger of all this.
Yeah, absolutely. And certainly conservative Christians would look at more liberal or progressive Christians and accuse them of exactly that. So I think you are definitely exposing the need for some very important conversations within the church. But I don't want to miss the climax here in terms of a conversation about the role of Israel and the Jewish people in the end times, because that's really that's the substance of what you're getting at in the book. Again,
sure.
Let me remind people. The author is Jonathan Burness. The book is Unlocking the Prophetic Mysteries of Israel, Seven Keys to Understanding Israel's Role in the End Times. You can check it out at jewishvoice.org. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Okay.
Tell us what Israel's role is.
Okay. In summary, the last two chapters focus on this entirely, and there's two phrases. One is life from the dead, and it's language from Romans chapter 11, where Paul is expounding, actually in Romans 9, 10, and 11, he's giving us the clearest teaching in the New Testament on the future of Israel. And to pick it up at Romans 11, he said, through their rejection, the rejection of most of the Jewish people, remember that all the first disciples were Jews, and they brought the gospel to the nations of the world. They lived as Jews. They never converted to another religion. But as a whole, the Jewish people did reject Jesus as their Messiah, and we're told that a blindness is covering their eyes, so that for a season. But Paul says it's through their rejection that salvation has now come to you Gentiles to provoke the Jews to jealousy. That's a mandate that every Christian bears, to provoke the Jewish people to jealousy. And I believe it also creates a linkage between what happens with Israel and what happens with the world. But then he goes on and says, if their rejection brought you salvation, what's going to happen when Israel comes back? What's going to happen when they return? And this is a huge key. He says it will bring life from the dead. Carmen, that connects biblically the salvation of the Jewish people, the restoration of the Jewish people, which includes them coming back to their land as well as coming back to God, with the outpouring of the Holy Spirit on the nations of the world, life from the dead. And then the second thing is called the restoration of all things, the seventh key, which is from Acts chapter 3, where Peter is preaching the gospel in the temple to the Jewish people. And he says, if you men of Israel will repent and turn to God, your sins will be blotted out. But not only that, it will also bring times of refreshing from the presence of the Lord and the return of his Son, who's been waiting in the heavenlies until the restoration of all things. What is the restoration of all things? It's everything the prophets spoke about would happen, culminating in a messianic age. And it's you can't see that coming to pass. That won't come to pass without Israel. Israel's at the center of it. And if Christians need to understand this and get involved and do their job, because every Christian has a mandate to reach the Jewish people and all people with the good news. That's it in a nutshell.
I know. All right. So, friends, if you want more, let me just say that you can actually go to jewishvoice.org, and you just scroll down a little bit on the homepage, and Jonathan is actually teaching on this subject matter. You can click on it. You can watch him. And so this is Rabbi Jonathan Burness, and if you want to soak yourself in teaching on this subject matter area, you can do so online at jewishvoice.org, and you can get the book, Unlocking the Prophetic Mysteries of Israel, Seven Keys to Understanding Israel's Role in the End Times. Jonathan, thank you so much for helping us to better understand and for everything you do every day.
Carmen, you too. It's always a pleasure to be with you. Keep up the great work.
Thank you so much. All right, friends, this Below the Fold will be really quick. So today's Below the Fold is about Starbucks and their new cup. So the Starbucks cup last year created a big brouhaha. The Starbucks holiday cup, as you might remember, was all red. They were made to be, I think, faux angry, but, you know, they acted angry anyway that the cup was all red. How dare Starbucks go with an all red cup? Well, first of all, let me just go back to last year for just a moment and say, okay, if you as a Christian can't make an appeal to somebody else based on a red cup, then we got some work to do, people. Red is actually the color of the blood. And so if that's a bridge too far for you to actually construct in a conversation with another person, you know, man, seriously, get it together. And the inside of the cup was white. You know, right? So I'm just saying, you ought to be able to make a gospel lesson out of a red cup with a white interior, even filled with dark liquid. So there you go. Okay, so let me move to this year's cup. I want to try to get ahead of the Starbucks cup brouhaha by actually sharing with you that this year's Starbucks cup features all kinds of Christmas images. Now, none of them are religious in nature, but here's the message that they are seeking to project. It's actually on the little snack bag. So if you get a goodie, this is what will be printed on your snack bag. It says, give good. Give good. I got to tell you, the message of give good is a gospel message. And so you and I have the opportunity to enter into the cultural conversation of the day. And you can talk about what it means to give and who gave and what Christmas is all about in terms of what God has given to us. God is certainly the giver of every good and perfect gift. Every good and perfect gift comes from our Father in heaven. And so we want to talk about the nature of the gift that God gives at Christmas, and that is Jesus. And then we want to talk about the nature of what it means to be good and who gets to define that. God's transcendental characteristics are beauty, goodness, and truth, right? Those are the transcendental virtues. We want to be lifting those up. When you want to give good and you want to start a conversation at Starbucks or about Starbucks, give people the good of the gospel. May they taste and see through you that the Lord is good. All right, friends, literally all the time we've got for today. This is The Reconnect. I'm Carmen LaBurge. Visit me online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. Have a great day and God bless.
The Reconnect is brought to you by the Presbyterian Lay Committee. To continue the conversation and become part of the Reconnect community, visit reconnectwithcarmen.com.